Un droit monde qui était difficile pour réaliser et a bâti un monde plus juste, une émission à la fois.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to Member Supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to Committee Watch and Comment for Tuesday, February 25th. I'm Dave Rabin. It's really good to be with you all. And later in the show, a documentary on the ongoing horror afflicting Palestinians on the West Bank. No other land is up for an Oscar, but it can't get a U.S. distributor, and other edgy docs can't either. We'll discuss with the New York Times, Alyssa Wilkinson and Mark Tracy. But first, President Trump is going after an array of targets flooding the field, as they say, and one of them is the media. It doesn't get perhaps the attention that it deserves. Some are calling it a true free speech emergency. And joining us to take a look at this state of affairs is the Freedom of the Press Foundation's Director of Advocacy, Seth Stearns. So great having you with us. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
It's really good to have you in these perilous times. And it'd be really good to have people call in. This is Community Watch and Comment, and we need your comments. 202-588-0893. Please don't hesitate. If you want to chime in, don't pause. Please do chime in. 202-588-0893. Before we get into the particulars, let's look at the current broad information landscape, says Stern. Trump already has in his pocket Fox News, X, Truth Social, powerful podcasts like Joe Rogan, Ben Shapiro, and his supporters largely are not following mainstream media. I think Hitler would really enjoy this landscape. It's far better landscape than he had back in the 30s. One could say. Your thoughts?
Well, it is certainly true that there is an ecosystem that Trump and the right have developed of media outlets that largely don't question them, and which, thanks to social media and particularly X, potentially Meta, which has now sort of sworn its loyalty to Trump, possibly TikTok, which its fate in the United States now largely rests in Trump's hand. You're absolutely right. Trump has enormous control over the public discourse, and particularly the portion of it that his followers listen to. That being said, I do still think there is room for good investigative journalism to break through, and if not get through to his most loyal followers, at least get through to some people who are on the fence, potentially rethinking their support of the Trump administration when they see some of its policies begin to hit home, which is inevitable. So I don't think it's a time to lose hope in the power of journalism to make a difference. There are some obstacles facing journalists that there didn't used to be. And certainly you can feel, if you're doing the kind of journalism that is so necessary at this point in time, you can feel like you're sort of screaming into the void because you're just getting cheers from people who are already with you and ignored or trolled by those who aren't. I can see how that's disheartening. But you know, the zeitgeist moves slowly and but can move, and I do still think journalism can break through. So hopefully people continue trying to make that happen.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm very glad for all the work that you and other groups like you are doing. I'm very glad having you on the show. You know, this is the time to put up the good fight, if you will. I mean, there's no question, but it's daunting. And, you know, you have to believe that, you know, the tide will be turning. I mean, inflation is not going down. You know, the price of eggs are not going down. So, you know, you've got to put up the good fight. There's absolutely no question. There's so many variables, I mean, operating here. And you have to hope that, as my 10th grade math teacher used to say, when a kid was answering incorrectly, and someone was saying, "Oh, no, Mr. Yeager, no, no, that's not right." He goes, "Silence. Let him hang himself and then jump on the rope." You know, you've got to keep laughing and you've got to keep fighting, because that's what's required in these perilous times. So let's go to some of the particulars. Trump's attacking mainstream media. I mean, one thing that really struck me is this. You know, Associated Press, I mean, that's kind of the ballast of so many news organizations, be it broadcast or otherwise, and AP, because they will not call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, as Trump would like. They're no longer allowed on Air Force One. I believe they're no longer allowed in the Oval Office. Your thoughts on that? I mean, it's really, I mean, AP is kind of the ballast. What, they've been around for over, what, 100 years, I think, since the 19th century.
Yeah. And I think you've got people on the right who think the AP has a liberal bias. You've probably got people on the left who think that the AP is too soft on Trump and is sort of representative of all the problems with legacy media. And regardless of all that, though, as you say, the AP plays a pretty crucial place in informing the American public, especially in news deserts or formerly great metropolitan newspapers that don't have the resources to cover DC themselves. So many papers are reliant on the AP's pool coverage, including papers Trump likes. So from putting aside the ethics and legalities and all of that, trying to put myself inside of Trump's head, I don't understand why he would want to deprive supporters of his in small towns across America from coverage of his silly signing ceremonies with his big Sharpie. That's what he's banning the AP from, covering essentially fluff pieces that would benefit him if it were able to go to the newspapers in the towns that rely on the AP. So, baffling move by the Trump administration, even practically. Legally speaking, of course, it's as unconstitutional as it gets. Trump's defense has mostly been, well, access to the president is a privilege, not a right. I'm just because past presidents let the AP in doesn't mean I have to. There's some truth to that, but you cannot deny that privilege once granted on the basis of constitutionally protected choices of words. If he wanted to, you know, rotate news outlets that have access to the Oval Office to open it up to more outlets on a content neutral basis, fine. That might even be a good idea, as long as it's done in good faith. But you cannot say, well, unless you toe the line, unless you print the words I want you to print, you don't have this access that you've previously been granted. That's blatantly unconstitutional. And I'm glad to see the AP standing up for itself, not capitulating like so many other publishers have. I'm glad to see other news outlets signing statements, signing onto briefs supporting the AP. I will say, though, that some of that support is going to need to come from outlets Trump likes. Otherwise, the media is really just giving him the tears of his victims, and I'm not sure that moves the needle. Once he starts hearing loudly from the Fox Newses and, you know, the Newsmaxes and the Breitbarts, whoever else it may be, that starts to give him reason to doubt himself. And those outlets, whatever you may think of them, and you probably think some of the same things I do, they're also protected by the First Amendment, and they should recognize that whatever rights Trump claims to weaponize against his perceived adversaries in the media, some future elected official or president from the other side of the political spectrum is going to use those same powers against the people who are currently benefiting from Trump. They should have enough foresight to anticipate that. They just spent 4 years complaining about a Democratic administration, so they can't claim, you know, naivete about the shoe being on the other foot. Hopefully they will stand by their principles and stand up to Trump on this one, and that might cause Trump to rethink what he's doing. That being said, my hope is that putting aside the legal issues, I sincerely hope that any reporter that is banished from spending an hour watching Trump sign executive orders in the Oval Office will spend that hour at the newsroom doing the kind of journalism that doesn't require that kind of access to the administration, doing aggressive investigative journalism, spending that extra time productively, making Trump regret giving them that extra hour to spend doing serious work of the Fourth Estate.
I mean, speaking of the Fourth Estate, I'm reminded of what Jefferson said, that, you know, if he had to choose between government and journalists, he would choose journalists. It's vitally important that we have what we call the Fourth Estate, i.e., journalism, standing up and letting the people know what the blank is going on with the current administration and with any administration. It's just terribly important. Let's take a look specifically at the FCC. The Federal Communications Commission, which is going after various networks. Before we get into the weeds on that, let's look at its chairman, Brendan Carr. If you could talk about him, because I think it's really important to understand that he's one of all these agency and cabinet appointments that are first and foremost Trump loyalists. And this is a man that was involved in Project 2025. If you could talk about Brendan Carr for a moment.
Yeah, I don't know whether Brendan Carr has always been such a Trump loyalist. I can't say that I've been following his career for over the course of years, but I've heard from some people that once upon a time, he was a fairly reasonable, moderate conservative, more of a traditional Republican. But he's obviously, like many in the Republican Party, taken a MAGA turn and now is an unprincipled partisan hack, doing whatever he thinks will make his boss look up from his Big Mac and smile. So, you know, that's who Brendan Carr has become. And that has resulted both as he was sort of campaigning to Trump for this job, and since he's gotten the job as chair of the FCC, in enforcement actions that are not in good faith, are expressly partisan, and that target outlets Trump dislikes. He showed his hand pretty much immediately. There were four complaints against news outlets that Carr's predecessor had dismissed prior to the end of the Biden administration. All of them meritless complaints attempting to police the content of broadcast journalism in ways the FCC never has before and cannot under the First Amendment. Carr revived the ones against ABC, CBS, and NBC, networks Trump does not like, did not revive the one against Fox, a network that Trump obviously likes far better. Of course, he has sort of played Trump's right-hand man in pursuing CBS over the Kamala Harris interview that Trump claims CBS distorted through its edits. Trump is pursuing a private lawsuit. Carr brought an FCC action. CBS, unfortunately, capitulated in a way by handing over the tapes and transcript to the FCC. Now, I just want to be clear there. I think CBS should have turned over the full transcript to the public far earlier. CBS is accountable to the public. The public has a right to determine whether it wants to watch CBS. This wasn't an interview involving privileged communications. This was an interview that was cut for time because 60 Minutes is a 60-minute show. There is no reason that the full interview couldn't have been posted on CBS's website. But to not give it to the public voluntarily and to go ahead and give it to CBS while having settlement conversations about about Trump's own lawsuit, that was rather unfortunate. And what Brendan Carr's gone and done since then is this form of internet mob justice, where he has posted on the FCC website. If you go to the FCC website to submit a comment or a complaint about anything you think the FCC should be investigating, you are prompted to submit public comment on whether CBS unlawfully distorted the interview with Kamala Harris, which, of course, it is up to journalists to decide how to edit interviews. There's no basis for the FCC to investigate CBS on interview editing. But instead of having experts on communications law and on the First Amendment, like Brendan Carr is supposed to be and perhaps once was, make that call, he seems to be trying to outsource it to, the MAGAverse. It's like a Twitter poll to determine the fate of CBS. It's pretty ridiculous. That's not all the FCC's done, though. They've gone after radio stations, also ones that Trump dislikes because their parent company allegedly has ties to George Soros and, everything, all the baggage in the views of Trump and his allies that come along with that, claiming that by identifying vehicles that ICE agents were driving during a raid, not by license plate, by make and model, a black Ford Explorer was on the screen, something like that, that they have identified ICE officers, endangered ICE officers, and thereby are not acting in the public interest, which is a broad term. FCC licensees are required to act in the public interest. But that's always been interpreted in deference to the First Amendment and with the understanding that it is not the place of the government to say what news the public is interested in hearing. Brendan Carr has taken it upon himself to say that it is not in the public's interest to hear the details of ICE operations and that it may cost radio stations that broadcast such important news their licenses, based on this stretched interpretation of the public interest provision. So, those are just a couple of examples, but what Carr is doing is taking this ambiguous wording that is included in certain FCC regulations, but has always been understood as being severely limited by the First Amendment and the prohibition on the government dictating editorial decisions. He is trying to expand that language to create legal pretext to pursue actions against news outlets the president dislikes. That's not even started. And of course, there are the attacks on PBS, NPR, so on, which he has said he wants to essentially eliminate entirely. So he is a very dangerous person within this administration.
Yeah. Let's focus, I should say, I'm speaking with Freedom of the Press Foundation's Director of Advocacy, Seth Stern. We'd love to hear from our listeners, 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Love to hear your comments, your thoughts on a really important issue that maybe is getting a bit lost in the fuselage, if you will, that's going on with Trump's flooding of the field, as they say, with just so many executive decisions, so many actions. Of course, these are actions outside the venue of a Congress, which is, I think, something that he learned in his first term, where he realized, oh boy, I'm even with majorities in both houses, it's going to be difficult to get things through Congress, so I'm going to just do it unilaterally. But he is a king wannabe, and this is what kings do. Let's focus, if you would, on NPR and PBS. he's going after these news outlets, these nonprofit educational news outlets. What he's saying that NPR is airing commercials, which, you know, something that, you know, I'm listening to a lot of NPR podcasts, and I frankly am getting tired of what are essentially commercials. I guess in the podcast, it's a different venue than broadcast media, but he's going after, you know, the actual broadcasts of NPR, the broadcasts of PBS, and questioning their underwriting approaches. If you could talk about that.
Right. Well, NPR and PBS have acknowledged their sponsors on air for quite some time. I don't think there's anything new there. I can't say that I am an expert on the particular regulations that govern what.
Go ahead, Seth.
I can't say I'm an expert on whatever regulations govern what can and cannot be said in those sponsorship disclosures, but at most, you would think that that would be a matter for a minor complaint and some sort of fine or correction. It is not something you would expect these giants of public media to be taken off the air because of. And if you read the letter that Carr sent about that issue, it is pretty clear that he is using this sponsorship disclosure or underwriting hook as exactly that, a pretext to go after funding of NPR and PBS entirely. He concludes the letter by offering his unsolicited personal opinion that in the modern media landscape, it is no longer necessary for the government to fund public media. That, of course, is an opinion he holds that has absolutely nothing to do with whether NPR's sponsorship disclosures say a couple too many words about the product of whatever company is sponsoring them. So I think that's part and parcel with the playbook we're seeing. Try to manufacture some petty violation based on some far-fetched and unprecedented legal hook, and take it to an extreme in terms of doing something so drastic as defunding American public media, as opposed to saying, hey, you guys should change the way you do these commercials, and here's a slap on the wrist. Pretty apparent what the agenda is here, and it's been no secret for years. The Republican Party has wanted to defund public media, despite that, again, small towns, news deserts across the country, including in red states, are very much reliant on public media for what the private sector is no longer able to provide in an economically viable way.
Yep, and we've got some hearings coming up. A subcommittee chaired by Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to look at PBS and NPR, the allegation is that they're systematically biased content providers. I don't know if you've heard about this specific thing, but I mean, it's Marjorie Taylor Greene. Oh my goodness. I mean, it's talk about weaponization. I mean, this is a firebrand Republican that's infamous, if you will, for going after, I think, important institutions. Now she's going to be going after NPR and PBS. And it's not hard to imagine the FCC going after Pacifica. If you could talk all about the above, and I know we've got a couple of callers. Let's let our esteemed guests respond, and then we'll get to you. I really appreciate you chiming in.
Yeah, it's hard to tell where they're going next. Of course, yes, you're exactly right. Some of the messengers for allegations of bias are humorous, even, you know, ironic, ridiculous, whatever you want to say. Bias is something that is pretty impossible to measure objectively, and anyone can find a means of alleging a certain network is biased for or against them if they so choose. It all depends on how you attempt to measure bias. But the fact of the matter is that the public broadcasters are independent of the government and have no obligation to be to give both sides equal time. Even if there were evidence of bias, it is not a basis to pull licenses or to pull funding. It would be a basis for listeners to stop listening if they felt that their perspectives weren't being represented. That's something that is between the broadcaster and its listeners. The editorial perspective, the bias, that's a journalistic decision, and broadcasters should listen to their communities and of course listen to the truth and adjust their content accordingly. They should not listen to the government. There is no better way of ensuring bias than having the government dictate content. Anyone who is truthfully concerned with bias in the government would stay far away, because that's how bias happens, when the government is dictating what journalists can and cannot do.
Yep. I mean, many would say that the Trump administration is following in the footsteps of the Orbán administration in Hungary, which has gotten a stranglehold on its media, along with its courts and every other established institution in that country. We've got callers. It's so wonderful that you're chiming in. First caller, if you care to give your name, where you're calling from, if you so like, and your question or your comment.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Yeah, first of all, I want to say that the particularly the white-controlled media are a bunch of cowards, because they're not telling the truth that people are speaking online. This is the Republicans are trying to engage in a bloodless coup d'etat of the United States of America. And the fact that the major press don't state clearly that that's what's happening is a testament to the fact that they are buying into the system. The Trump and all of his cohorts, they're traitors to the United States of America. And that's been stated over and over online, but for some reason, the press won't say, the white-controlled corporate press, and even Pacifica, won't say the common thing that everybody can see with their eye. They are traitors to the United States. They do not believe in the Constitution. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not believe in equity and all that stuff that the Constitution, you know, philosophically states. The other thing I say is, the white-controlled corporate media doesn't allow other voices besides Democrats to state what's going on in this country. They don't interview even Ralph Nader. They don't bring in Jill Stein or Cynthia McKinney. This is not a country of just Democrats and Republicans. And they only want to limit the voices of these weak Democrats as an alternative to what people can do and think regarding this coup d'etat that's trying to take place in the United States. So I
we are running out of time. I think we got the gist of what you're saying. Thank you so much for chiming in. Your thoughts, Seth Stern.
Yeah, there's certainly, you know, merit to that. We're not here to defend the press as an institution or to say that everything the press does is perfect. We're here to defend press rights and press freedom. And absolutely, the press should be incorporating voices beyond the Democratic Party as alternatives to the Trump administration. I certainly agree with that. There are voices out there doing exactly that. They're not really being platformed as they should. I wish I remembered the name of the journalist I'm thinking of, but there is somebody who has been doing this experiment of reporting on the Trump administration using the language that the press would be using if the exact same thing were happening in another country, and seeing it reported that way, which I think there are valid arguments that's the way it should be reported. It's quite striking to observe the differences.
Interesting. I think we have another caller. Thank you so much for chiming in. Your name, if you care to, where you're calling from, and your question or comment. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi, hello, are you with us?
Yes, would it be me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Okay, wonderful. I heard what you were saying about PBS, and I hate to ask this question or make this comment question because it might seem like I'm on their side, on the side of Trump and the other people, but I also, for the last number of years, have been wondering about whether or not the sponsor or people who gave money being having all that information given about their company and whatnot was a commercial. And I heard you talk about something that, they weren't proposing, but they're not actually relating some information sometimes, letting the people know, the public know. For example, I was with a group, and we wanted information about certain vaccines and other things which went against the profits that the pharmaceutical companies were making. And it got no hearing whatsoever from the things. And we wanted some comparison of, for example, ivermectin. We wanted a comparative studies, which were refused by the CDC and Fauci, and you cannot get a certain version on. So I think even if it looks like they're neutral and they're not doing certain things, they will not comment on certain things. And I think that there is censorship, and it may have to do with both government and the commercial sponsors to PBS, and something needs to be looked into on that, I think. And that's the only reason why I was not a member of the people going after Robert F. Kennedy, who disappointed me very deeply with his Palestinian proposals that they be eliminated and whatever. But at the same time, I'm very looking at the PBS and other things, and I'm wondering if there is some bias there that is not being really shown to the public.
I appreciate you chiming in. Thanks so much, Sester, and your thoughts.
Oh, well, you're certainly welcome. I hope that something, maybe bring back the fairness doctrine or something. The media has changed, and I don't think, that just speaking to people is not a crime. Just speaking to, and it should not be a big event. If a news media speaks to Putin, why aren't we hearing Putin anyway on the major media? I like to hear him on PBS, just like I like to hear American leaders on it. And I hope that comes about again.
Thanks so much for your thoughts. Seth Stern, your thoughts on your caller's concerns.
Yeah, I'm not going to dispute anyone's views about media outlets being biased or covering the wrong stories. Those are opinions that everyone's entitled to hold. And I think that folks who take issue with certain news outlets, whether PBS or any other, should raise those issues with those news outlets and should find like-minded people to raise those issues along with them and perhaps get different perspectives represented that should be represented. I have no problem with that at all. Where I do have a problem is the government stepping in. I don't want to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine is unconstitutional and will lead to not only more biased coverage, but difficulty pursuing truth. You can't give everyone equal sides when one side is true and one side is misinformation. So I'm all for a discourse about the many problems the media has. We are not here to say that journalism is perfect. Journalism has plenty of problems. I just don't want to see the government be the ones to solve it.
Yeah. So we are approaching the end of our time with Seth Stern. Any recommendations about what people can do? I mean, a lot of folks, including you could say the Democratic Party, has been caught a little bit flat-footed by this deluge that the first month of the Trump administration. Any thoughts about what people can do? You're the director of advocacy at the foundation, so please chime in on whatever directions you might recommend.
Well, subscribe to your local newspaper, support your local media outlets. Fighting fascism costs money. Lawyers are expensive. And without financial support from their communities, outlets that need to put up that fight simply will not be able to. There are plenty of nonprofits and NGOs that are able to help in the fight, but look, they're slammed too. There are a lot of fires to put out. So it's very important that members of the community who are able to afford it put their dollars up. Besides that, make it known that press freedom is important to you, that you appreciate the role of the Fourth Estate and that you don't want government to interfere in the Fourth Estate. We've had this rise in distrust of institutions, which is a good thing for the most part, but for some reason, the press is seen as one of the institutions to distrust, as opposed to a check on the institutions that are distrusted. Part of that is the press's fault, but we need to reverse that. We need to reverse that thinking. If we distrust institutions, we need to support a free press, particularly people on the right whose opinions Donald Trump cares about, need to be vocal about the importance of the Fourth Estate.
Yeah. Where can people follow the important work of Freedom of the Press Foundation that you're the director of advocacy for?
Our website is freedom.press. You can subscribe to any of our numerous newsletters or follow us on a social media platform of your choosing.
Wonderful. Seth Stern, I really appreciate all you're doing. Appreciate you being with us today. He's the Freedom of the Press Foundation Director of Advocacy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And on to a couple of other pillars of the Fourth Estate, a documentary on the ongoing oppression of Palestinians on the West Bank, No Other Land, is up for an Oscar. No Other Land received the Best Documentary Prize at the Berlin International Film Festival, where it premiered last February, and similar recognition recently from the New York Film Critics Circle and the International Documentary Association. It has been acquired for distribution in at least 24 countries, including the United Kingdom and France, but it can't get a U.S. studio distributor and no streaming platform. And other edgy docs can't either. What is going on? We're joined now by New York Times Alyssa Wilkerson and Mark Tracy. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
It's really great having you. And as always, we'd like for our callers to chime in 202-588-0893. Alyssa Wilkerson, your executive summary, if you will, of No Other Land. I just saw it last night. I'm fortunate to live in D.C. and was able to go to the American Film Institute and see it. A lot of folks, you all are, in New York or wherever. I shouldn't assume that you're in New York. In fact, Mark Tracy is a Bethesda native, if I'm not mistaken. Forgive me for outing you.
But, I don't know. Proud of it. But yes, in New York now.
Yeah.
A lot of people can't see this film. You know, we had a showing we have an incredible kind of literary restaurant chain called Busboys and Poets. There was a viewing there. It sold out over a week ahead. I couldn't get a ticket, but I had American Film Institute to see it. But yeah, we're fortunate. Alyssa, if you could give us your summary of what the film is about. It's really quite powerful, quite devastating.
It is, yeah. It's a documentary made by a filmmaking team of two Palestinian and two Israeli filmmakers, and it sort of documents over a long period of several years the experience of particularly one of the filmmakers families and community in the occupied West Bank, in an area that has repeatedly had buildings and homes destroyed and people move into caves. And the experience that they've kind of had, and it combines a mix of documentary footage, home video footage, sort of footage that is shot during moments where those homes are being destroyed by the military. And it's a film that, I mean, it's right there in the title. It asks, like, what other land do we even have to go to? Like, this is our home. And so it's obviously a film that was made prior to the current conflict, but it's become more urgent, I think, over the past year, which helps account for some of its reception over all of that time. And it did indeed win the Silver Bear in Berlin, and then it's just won basically every documentary award that there is to win this year, including the ones you named. And part of the issue has been that typically a film with this kind of acclaim would get picked up by some streamer or distributor for distribution in the US. It has in many other territories, as you say. Like, for instance, if you look it up, it'll say you can watch it on Apple TV, but that's actually only in the UK. You can't watch it in the US. So they wound up having to self-distribute. So anytime you see it playing at a theater, it's because there's a self-distribution going on where they, you know, basically have gone to the theater and made space. And so it is playing in major cities. If people are interested, they can probably request a booking if there's enough interest in a community. But, you know, the topic obviously is one that is one that's controversial in the U.S. right now, but not only in the U.S. But on top of it, and this is something Mark wrote about, and I'm sure we'll talk about, but there's been a move, I think, as tech companies have kind of owned the streamers more and more, away from the kinds of films that they would have picked up in the past. Often years ago, if you went to Sundance and you saw a controversial political documentary, it would almost immediately get snapped up by a streamer. Maybe Amazon Prime or Netflix or something like that, because they knew there would be interest in the topic. And that it seems like this year there's been a big shift away from that, whatever the topic is.
Right. Right. Mark Tracy, your thoughts about, you know, why this hasn't, this documentary hasn't been picked up. I mean, the studios, the distributors can make a buck on it. It's of interest, you know, but it's not happening. Your thoughts, if you would.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's important to remember that as much as self-distribution is something of a strategy, you know, the model for filmmakers to make these films, you know, movies are very capital intensive, right? Like, it's not like writing a book even. You have to pay for so many things. So to have this kind of freezing of the market for topical films is bound to discourage the future making of topical films, some of which have been, you know, very important. You know, in No Other Land's case, it's certainly a hot button issue, and it's definitely the perspective of the movie is very defiantly anti-occupation. So it could be that. It could also just be kind of more broadly kind of almost apolitical trends of just you know, distributors and especially streamers shying away from any kind of topical documentary and shying towards what really works, which has been true crime. You know, sports is very big in the documentary space. And look, I'm a sports fan. I used to cover sports for the Times, actually. I watched all 10 episodes of the Jordan documentary, and I certainly don't apologize for that. But what's so strange is that there was a market for these films, for these kinds of films, I should say, 5 years ago. RBG did good run in the theater. I Am Not Your Negro by James Baldwin. I saw that at a theater near me. You know, not these are not $100 million movies, to be sure, but they also don't cost $100 million to acquire, so it was cost effective. So this year, in addition to No Other Land, there have been at least two other notable topical documentaries. One is also actually about Israel. It's called The Bibi Files, but with a very different perspective and a very different emphasis than No Other Land. And I've seen that one by the filmmaker Alexis Bloom, and connected to one of the most prominent documentary kind of production companies, still wasn't acquired. And Union, which was this is a movie about also a great movie. I think Alyssa is a particular fan of that one. You know, again, and also like we're not just talking about these are movies that are topical and hard hitting. They're also like well-made movies. I mean, I'm not a critic, so I don't want to get too over my skis here, but like as a frequent film goer, like these are really good movies. And a number of these, especially No Other Land and Union, like appeared on top 10 lists. So for them not to be acquired at all suggests a true freezing of the market for, and sorry, I should say Union. The movie Union is about the unionization of an Amazon factory on Staten Island, with kind of crazy access that the filmmakers had to that whole process, including like hidden cameras and like in that Amazon workers supplied footage from. For them not to be acquired at all, for it to be such a lift to stream them. And they're not completely unstreamable. Actually, No Other Land, I think, maybe is at this point unstreamable. The others, you can find them, but like it's a real lift and it costs a lot of money. Whereas, you know, 5 years ago, they would have been, one imagines, on the equivalent of Hulu or Frontline or Netflix or Amazon or what have you, or even rentable from Amazon or Apple for $2.99 or $3.99. Not you have to go to a special site that hosts documentaries and pay $12. So it's just a lot of people in the documentary field are really disturbed by this because yes, it's probably partly political, but it's also probably partly not political. It's probably a lack of interest from distributors in getting these films in front of people. So that does not bode well for the future of these kinds of movies.
I mean, do you really feel like it's a lack of interest? And I'd like Alyssa to weigh in too. I mean, isn't it, you know, certainly in the case of a documentary that's extremely critical of Israel and its actions in the West Bank, I mean, you've got to think that this has to do with concern about the backlash that the distributors might get from the Israeli lobby in this country. I mean, they're very powerful. I mean, you've got, you know, an indicted war criminal in the, you mentioned the documentary on Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, he's addressing last summer a joint session of Congress. I mean, obviously there's a serious...
I mean,
sure, but at the same time, he's not popular. He's not all that popular to move to the BB files. He's not all that popular in Israel, much less here.
Right.
He's a polarizing figure. You know?
There's a definite, you know, I think the curiosity here is that frequently being controversial is how documentaries have made money, you know, have generated interest, have created conversations, have won awards. Like there's no dearth of controversial documentaries in the history of documentary that have become very significant and important. And it was, you know, in the case of Union, for instance, we're looking at a movie that it was on my top 10 list, is made by very important and award-winning filmmakers. And as Mark says, has all this interesting access. I mean, it plays like a thriller in a lot of places. And it's about something that touches everyone's lives. Like everybody's interested in Amazon to some level. And it's not, you know, we can make inferences and draw lines between the whys, but there's the truth about Hollywood is that it's, you know, it's always quite conservative in terms of money talks. And perhaps there's just a perception that these movies won't make money because of, I don't know, who knows? We don't know the answer to it. It's more of like a trend that's observable, that is troubling and funny and interesting in a lot of ways when you compare it to just 5 years ago. So in 2019, before I joined the Times, I was on the documentary film jury at Sundance. And it was like a very interesting experience. I had a great time just watching all these movies. But the big winner, or the big money winner that year, was the film Knock Down the House, which Netflix bought for, I think, like $10 million. It was like a 10, lot of money.
It was roughly $10 million.
Yeah, which is a huge amount of money to spend on a documentary. And it was about, you know, AOC and the other members of that cohort being elected to their positions in Congress. And I think that movie would never get picked up for $10 million today, certainly at Sundance. But when you think about what the strategy there was, Netflix assumed that people would be interested in and want to see this movie, even if they didn't agree with it. And that's just not something that seems to be happening.
So it was the Sundance documentary record until last year's Sundance, when it was broken by the documentary about Christopher Reeve. So a celebrity documentary,
so
right?
That's right. The celebrity documentary and the rock documentary have really taken over as the form that people are willing to spend money on. I will also say that I don't, you know, having watched and covered Hollywood for a long time, I don't think that these decisions are often made from positions of data and information. They're often made on kind of vibes and feelings in the room. So I wouldn't, you know, we can't attribute it necessarily to actual evidence that people aren't interested in these topics. I think they often are. It's just a feeling that somebody had, but it seems to be more and more industry-wide. And I think it does also indicate two things. One is there's a contraction in the documentary market. There's just not as much money flowing to things that aren't surefire hits. And also to sort of the opportunity that's in the market for someone with a taste for a little bit of risk and maybe courage, depending on who you're talking to try distributing these movies in places that the big companies are unwilling to tread right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I wasn't even aware of the BB Files and the Union documentary until reading Mark Tracy's article. I mean, that's, and I'm not exactly oblivious.
These distributors, part of the reason is these distributors, they know how to market movies. This is their job, right? If a distributor had you know, picked up this movie, whether for theater and streaming or even just for streaming, like, their job is to let you
make
know
sure
about
you
this
heard
movie.
Of it. That's right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, without that money, it's just very, that's one of the major things that comes along with the distribution deal is awareness. And, you know, No Other Land is a film that's had a lot of awareness because, I mean, lots of people, including us, keep writing about it. But another film that falls under this rubric that I started getting emails about yesterday, and I wrote about it a while ago, is a movie called The Last Republican, which is about the former congressperson Adam Kinzinger. And it's directed, oddly enough, by the man who made Hot Tub Time Machine, among other kind of big Hollywood movies. And it's quite a good movie. And in many ways, I think fits the sort of rubric that you might think people would be looking for, which is it's kind of about like bipartisanship and where is like courage over party and things like that. Just feels very of the moment. And yet it couldn't secure a major distribution deal either. So there is a sense in which some movies are getting caught in a moment where the tastes of the decision makers have changed, seemingly. But it is also true that there's a bunch of great movies that did excellent festival runs and have won awards that are just sort of floating around out there waiting to be seen. And I can say from my perspective, you know, I write a documentary column for The Times, and I often write about these movies because they open in New York for a week or something like that. And I just get endless. I got an email literally as we were sitting here from someone asking me how they can see No Other Land. So I just get an endless stream of emails from people who are interested in this. So there is some kind of an opportunity there.
You know, and it's terribly important. You guys are too young to at least, you probably know of the documentary Hearts and Minds on Vietnam.
Certainly.
But you're too young to, you know, I was watching that when it came out in, 1974 on Vietnam, and I can't recommend it enough. It's extraordinarily powerful. But documentaries are so important. I mean, for breaking through and giving you a serious sense. I mean, you know, we hear about housing demolitions, school demolitions in the West Bank, but seeing No Other Land is a real visceral experience. I mean, documentaries really bring it home, and it's a terribly important subject. So glad that you all are writing about it or following it. We are running out of time. Real quickly, your predictions about Sunday night, Oscar night. You think? What do you think's going to happen? Is No Other Land going to break through, or the Hollywood malaise is going to keep it from happening? It has some quote-unquote sexy competitors. What do you think?
I'm pretty sure it will be No Other Land, but I will say every documentary nominated in the category this year is like ripped from the headlines up to the moment, very important sort of movies to see. There's not a single celebrity portrait or sports doc in there this year, which is rare. So I recommend all of them. I'll have a column on that this weekend, but I recommend all of them.
I haven't seen Sugar King, but I hear it's
also incredible,
terrific.
Incredible film. Yeah, every single one of them. So I'll be happy with any winner, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be No Other Land.
We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. I can't thank you both enough for joining us. I've been speaking to the New York Times, Alyssa Wilkinson, and Mark Tracy. Thank you so much for all you do for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for our show. It's great having you with us. Thanks to the amazing Mike for his engineering expertise. Coming up, we've got the news headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with the wonderful Lady Murr. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Dave Raven, stay safe and have a good week.
Hola mi gente, soy Oscar Fernandez de Latino Media Collective en WPFW, aquí para decirle a ustedes que todas las personas en los Estados Unidos tienen derechos independientemente de su estatus migratorio, y conociendo nuestros derechos es el primer paso para mantenernos a distancia de las violaciones de nuestros derechos como ICE y otras fuerzas de orden. Por eso le presento una guía para proteger sus derechos. Número 1. Identifique los contactos de emergencia y memorice sus números. Número 2. Mantenga la calma si se acerca el ICE u otras fuerzas del orden. No corra, discuta, resista ni pelea. Número 3. Tenemos el derecho a permanecer en silencio. Número 4. Tiene derecho a hablar con un abogado y no firmar nada hasta que lo discuta con un abogado. Número 5. Si está en su casa, tiene derecho a negarse a entrar a menos que se le presente una orden judicial firmada por un juez. Una orden de ICE no permite la entrada a su casa. Y finalmente, número 6, usted tiene derecho a un intérprete. WPFW está aquí defendiendo los derechos humanos ganados con dificultad, construyendo un mundo más justo, transmisión a transmisión.
For close to 50 years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of Black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black history. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801 will help to protect this medium in the Black radical tradition so that we can continue to chronicle Black hope, sorrow, and resistance.
On Thursday, February 27th, the Howard University Department of Political Science and Howard Kwame Ture Society present the event Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, with veteran Black Panther Party member, Black Liberation Army leader, and former political prisoner Daruba Bin-Wahad, who will deliver an analysis on how today's resurgent right-wing agenda is an outgrowth of the ongoing and historical political struggle and what fight-back strategies should look like. That's Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, Thursday, February 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Howard University's Douglas Hall, Room 221, at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More information and registration for this event can be found on the webpage, daruba@howard.eventbrite.com. That's D-H-O-R-U-B-A at, that's A-T, howard.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org.